CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 74, with Dr. Robert Weinstock by Emmanuel Faco, double torque eye wells, and much, much more.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, a friend for 20 years. Yes, it's been that long. That's Dr. Rob Weinstock there in Florida, Eye Institute of West Florida. Rob, you're an amazing surgeon. I just saw a video of you operating at the ACOS Deer Valley meeting, where you put two toric eye wells in the bag for a patient with high corneal astigmatism. Wow, I didn't even heard of that.
Yeah, sometimes we got to get creative, you know. These patients, they come in wanting great vision, and sometimes you got to use all the tools in the tool bag to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, in the U.S., I guess our highest toric eye well power is correct about, like, what, 4 diopters at the corneal plane? Something like that?
Yeah, about 4, and, you know, I know at OUS there's other options, but, you know, those are hard to come by. You got to send a patient overseas to get that or a special order something. So, you know, we've been using piggybacks for a long time, right, in refractive error cases, especially, hyperopia after cataract surgery is better treated with the piggyback sometimes. This patient was interesting because they actually had keratoconus, which historically they've always thought taboo was, you know, you don't want to mess with that. Keep them in their hard contacts. This poor guy, he couldn't wear hard contacts anymore. Miserable in glasses. He had like 10 diopters of astigmatism, maybe 12, but it was regular. Now, one of his eyes looked terrible, irregular cone. The other eye, keratoconus, but across the visual axis, the central 3 to 4 millimeters, there was pretty regular spill, maybe like 10 or 11 diopters inferiorly and like 8 or 9 superiorly. Very obvious axis. His glasses showed the axis. So we took 2 T9s and we piggybacked them in the bag. So I think he called for like a 20. So we did a 14 in the bag and then a 6 on top of that, both T9. 6 is the lowest it goes. A +6 is the lowest. So I picked the lowest power plus the residual to make up for the total of 20. Of course, there's a little bit of a guessing game with where the lens is going to sit with ELP. He wound up, you know, spherical equivalent of close to plano with only a buck of sill left. And yeah, most functional vision he's ever had. So pretty exciting.
That's amazing. I think you brought up a couple important points there. One was, look at that central 3 or 4 millimeter zone that corresponds with pupil. Sometimes we get too carried away with what's at the 9 and 10 millimeters on the cornea, and the patients never even looking through that.
Yeah, you're right. And sometimes the central cornea is just a mess, like between the superior and inferior, just off the visual axis, you have like 7, 8, 9 diopters difference of power. That's not going to work with a toric. That's going to be a mess. But if it's pretty regular, like kind of blur out in your mind all the rest of the cornea, just look at the central 3 to 4, see how regular that looks. And whether they tolerate glasses gives it away too. If you've got a regular pair of glasses with high sill built in, and that's what they use or use a lot and can get by with that, they're going to tolerate a toric if you get it on axis, if they're tolerating in their spectacles.
That's a great point, because the glasses, spectacles, are only going to fix sphere and sill.
Right.
And the glasses have regular sill like our toric eye wells. So right. He's pretty happy with his glasses treatment, and it's the same consistent axis, then a toric eye well is almost a slam dunk.
It is. It is. And, you know, there was old literature, and we keep coming back to this. What about this issue of between the lens haze or fibrosis or membrane formation, intralenticular?
Right. What about that?
Well, I think when you and I were in residency, we heard these oddball cases, and we got scared, and we were like, we can't do that. You can never do it. We get trapped sometimes in this dogma or paradigms of what's been shown in the literature. Maybe it was just a few cases. Maybe it was probably a different lens altogether. It wasn't the Clareon platform at all. So myself and other surgeons, you know, if it works in the sulcus space, well, why wouldn't it work in the bag too? It doesn't happen often, but I've probably had maybe 15 or 20 cases over the years now that I've put 2 lenses in the bag, and it's worked really well. I've yet to see any type of intralenticular haze buildup.
Right. And plus today we have much better surgical techniques. In the rare case you do get some intralenticular pacification, you can always go in there with like small gauge, 25 gauge vitrector, two limbal incisions, go in and clean anything out. You can always do that.
You absolutely could. Yeah. No, we've really come along in our small incision techniques and instrumentation. You know, you got a lot of cataract guys out there like you and I that kind of borrow our retina colleagues' instruments from time to time, these little membrane peelers and little micro forceps, especially in the age of Yamanis and Somin IOLs. I'm doing trocars and using retina instruments all the time to manipulate IOLs in an unusual case.
Well, that's for sure. Every retina person in Los Angeles that I've met, way smarter than me. So like, what's on his tray or her tray? Let me borrow that. Let me learn a few tricks here.
You know, let me ask you this. I have this patient I'm sharing with one of my retina colleagues. The guy lost his whole lens and capsule somewhere in the eye, disappeared, okay? Fell, had cataract surgery 20 years ago, probably has pseudo exfoliation, dislocated. He came in, you know, count fingers. He said, my vision just dropped and went away and disappeared. His retina looks great. We can't find the lens. We cannot find this IOL. And I sent him to retina. He couldn't find him. And his answer to me, because I was saying, well, you go get the lens and then I'll sew in a lens when you fish it out. I'll put a new one. Couldn't find it. He thinks it must be hiding behind the iris or the ciliary body or the vitreous base anteriorly. What do we do, Dave? Like, I'm thinking, I asked him, I said, do the retina guys have a mirror like the dentists use that you could put inside the eye and look back behind there?
So I've seen a case like this, as crazy as it sounds, at the county hospital. And the lens was basically, patient dilated like 4 or 5 millimeters. The lens was partly behind the iris, basically between the edge of the, between the back part of the iris and pars plana. That's where the lens is sitting there. And the only way we could examine and find the lens for the patient was, as crazy as it sounds, we had the patient in the clinic lie on a gurney, prone on his belly, looking down at the ground. And I went under the patient lying on the floor with an indirect ophthalmoscope, used his and 20 Doppler lens, used his magnification. And then with gravity, the lens came into his visual axis.
That's pretty cool.
Then we took him back to the OR, and then the retina fellow at the time ended up like kind of poking around, knowing where the lens was sitting. When he made his trocars in pars plana, he made sure he put a trocar pushing right where the lens was, and it pushed it forward.
That's so awesome. I got a crazy one similar. I dropped a nucleus one time.
We all do.
Okay, I dropped a nucleus, very dense cataract. I had the guy flip over on his stomach.
No kidding.
And the lens dropped. Well, first I put some pilo in his eye, and then I had him flip over, and the lens fell into the anterior chamber, and the pilo constricted the pupil and trapped the lens in the AC, and I flipped him backward, and then I got it out. It only worked one time. I've tried it multiple times. I got lucky.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, too, which is 100% of world expert cataract surgeons have dropped the nucleus, and on multiple occasions.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like the more cataract surgery you do, the more likely are you're going to be sent some case that it's almost impossible not to. The zonules are hanging on by a thread. It's a cataract, either trauma, multiple retina surgeries, you name it, open posterior capsule. It's just part of doing what we do.
I got a patient sent to me by a medical retina specialist, a non-surgeon, who said, patient has a white cataract. Could you take care of it? I said, sure. I said, could you send me the last couple clinic notes? And normal lens, clear lens, one plus NS, got an intravitreal injection. A week later, white cataract. Let me think. So I put the A-scan up. We don't have to whip out the A-scan, but the guy was so opaque, there was no view at all. I put the A-scan up, and I can just see the lens thick as the poster. I can see it's open. I can see fluffy stuff floating in the vitreous. Come on already. It's already open.
Well, and, you know, I think it's becoming more common for us to see these cases, and it's now it's like I used to never do this, but now it's routine to put in a trocar. So I've got posterior access. I know the capsule's open. Right. If you're going to put in a trocar, you got to do it in the beginning of the case before you get in there and solve it.
While the eye's firm. Yes.
So you got to get that trocar in, and you know the capsule's open. and you have a much easier time cleaning things up. You don't need a retina guide for that. You can clean up vast majority of anything. A little bit of cortex floating around in the vitreous is going to resolve.
Right.
Right. Soft white cataract, you catch it up, you push it up, you use the vitrector for the posterior approach. You can switch back and forth between an anterior and posterior approach. And most of the time it goes just fine with that trocar.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. But, you know, I loved it. As I say, share the love and the liability with the retina folks.
Yes. Yes.
So I kind of like to do both. The other thing you mentioned that was actually really important here is, you know, again, the central few millimeters, and then again, it's important that the patient can see in spectacles. So I'm going to try that now. Next time I have a patient who needs beyond that, I'm going to try doing the double, you know, piggyback, double IOL, toric lens in the bag, get them lined up. Now, how do you, was it any challenge in getting the access right on both lenses?
No. I used the LensR with iris registration and the capsular right. depth. So I had a visual guide.
Oh, makes it easy.
Registered where to put the first one. First one was just like a normal routine.
Right.
The second one, I added a little more viscoelastic jelly. And I put the lens in, and with the jelly still in the eye, so I had a little bit of some lubricant, so to speak, to manipulate that second lens, I gently just rotated it so those haptics were sitting directly on top of each other. Now, a lot of people are like, well, how is it going to fit in the bag? You know, you get questions like that from the fellows, like, how can two lenses? Well, guess what? A cataract is 5 millimeters thick.
Right.
An IOL is
one.
So you could put 5 lenses in the bag probably. If you
right.
Know, right? There's plenty of room in there. But yeah, you just have to tease it. But that material, Clarion acrylic material, hydrophobic acrylic, it's sticky. It's going to stick to each other. So you do want to realize that once you evacuate that viscoelastic, it's hard. They're going to be stuck on each other. It's going to be hard to get them to rotate. So get them in position and then evacuate all the viscoelastic.
Well, that's actually a very important point because, yeah, we all see that. You put a lens in the eye and the haptic kind of like stuck or kissing haptic stuck on the optic. So it's a little tacky. You're right. So get a final position, then take out a viscoelastic, then you're good to go.
Yes. Yeah. And if there's a little leftover viscoelastic between the two lenses, that's okay. As long as you seal the eye up well and you leave the operating room with the two lenses in good position, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, good point. And you also mentioned your fellows were making a comment. So you have a really amazing fellowship. You know, I think when we were residents back, I finished residency 2000. I think you were a year after 2001.
Yeah.
When we finished residency, these types of fellowships didn't really exist, which are super high volume surgical, and they're really just basically anterior segment surgery.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about your fellowship because I've had so many amazing stories from your fellowship. A good friend of ours in common. Bo Swan, who did your fellowship, said, best year of his life.
Oh, that's sweet. Well, you know, when you and I came out, if you were to go do a fellowship that wasn't a traditional fellowship, you were going to go do a refracted fellowship, but you were just going to bang out LASIK all day. Because in 2001, right, that it was cranking. And there were fellowships like that, right? Like Dick had one that was heavy in LASIK, and Dan Dury had one, and Steve Slade had one. But you didn't get inside the eye because at that time, it was LASIK. That was the hot surgery. Well, fast forward, you know, cataract surgery is the new LASIK. You got all these different refractive technologies. Mm-hmm. Patients are coming in their 50s and 60s now thinking they want LASIK, or they're coming in for a clear lens replacement. They've heard of that. Or they just want cataract surgery and no glasses. So when I saw that shifting from saying corneal-based refractive surgery to lenticular-based refractive surgery. Mm-hmm. And clearly here in Florida, we have a demographic that's pretty drifted towards geriatrics and older patients. I just see many, many more lenticular-based candidates than I do corneal-based candidates for refractive surgery. So I just realized there wasn't any training in it. And, you know,
right.
My dad, and you know how passionate he's always been about cataract surgery and being on the cutting edge. And he instilled that in me, and I did that, and I really made that a passion of mine with refractive cataract surgery early on. And then I had to share it because, it was not so much, it's for the surgeons, but you know who it's really for? It's really for the patients.
Yes, for sure.
Really dangerous for patients to get subjected to surgeons that have only done 100 or 200 cataracts in a training environment.
Right.
We got to be honest about it. Right. I know it's the paradigm, but just like glaucoma and retina and cornea, if you want to be great at something, you need to go do some extra training. And that was the impetus behind the cataract and refractive fellowship and anterior segment fellowship we started about 10 years ago.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, you do everything from keratorefractive surgery to phakic IOLs to obviously all kinds of cataract surgery, challenging cases, lens-based refractive surgery, MIGS surgery. It's like a beautiful, it's like a complete anterior segment refractive plus complex disease fellowship. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I'm not the only one. There must be like 7, 8, 10 of us now that are offering this at a private sector, a high
volume. Oh, for sure.
And it's growing. I think anybody who has knowledge to share and has a practice like that would be doing a huge benefit to our field to open up a fellowship position. And by the way, it's a great value. I mean, the PGY 5 salary is a very reasonable, like the cost of a technician, and you've got a technician plus next to you working. Right. And things they can do for you and see your post-ops and help you get through clinic and do the femtosecond laser and do LASIK enhancements for you. It goes on and on, the value. And it's just a wonderful re-engagement in the whole field. So like, you know, it gets a little routine what we do sometimes, right? This is a way to spice it up in a really great way.
Oh, I love it. Now, you're convincing me. I got to start my own now, too.
You do.
At some point, we'll put it on the back, but at some point, I'm going to really consider it. You know, you also mentioned about your pops, your dad. Wow. One of a very influential people that I first met when I was probably like, I don't know, 33, 34 years old. I can't believe it's been 50 years since he started that practice.
Yeah. 50 wow. years. And still coming in at 83 years old, doing YAG capsulotomies, knocking 20 or 30 of those out in the afternoon, seeing some friends and patients. And, you know, the fellows love talking to him. I mean, the wisdom is crazy. And
he's like the godfather, man. I love it.
And we have mentors still, you know, that we talk to all the time. It's just so important. There is no substitute for experience. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't matter how good your hands are, or where you've trained. It's all about experience.
And right. Yeah, the wisdom is hard to pick up in a brief amount of time. So, as you said, it's very helpful to have a mentor. You can pick someone's brains every once in a while. Hey, let me get some insight from you. Because that wisdom is hard to come by.
Yeah, I mean, I tell my fellows, even after spending a year with me, when you get out into practice, you got to find another mentor. Right. You got to find your next mentor, because you're going to have a black cataract or a white cataract, or an eye like you described it, the poster captions were. You've still only done 1,000 cataracts. That's not a lot. It may seem like a lot. It's not. You need to go do someone who's done thousands and thousands and has been doing it for a long time and knows how the eye reacts and responds to things. At least have them standing over your shoulder, or go operate on a day, put it on a schedule, let them watch you and help you. You're never too good that you can't learn from someone or get some help or advice.
Right. It's why I started a cataract coach. You know why? Because I realized even my favorite tennis player of all time, Roger Federer, world champion, he's got a coach. He could beat his coach in tennis, but he needs his coach to be even a better player.
Yes. And I can't imagine what a better surgeon has made you.
Oh, I learned so much every day.
Right. I mean, more than anybody. I mean, because you've seen so many things and you have to edit them and you tear apart the nuances. And that's what you have to do to be great. You have to pick it apart, like Federer, like Djokovic. They've torn apart the game of tennis. Like nobody else. All the masters have torn their business apart and have taken it to a level that nobody else has. And that's the only way to become a master, is to get to that level.
Right. If we look back at our careers, here's some great insight, because I love to teach the younger generation, the 30s and 40s year old ophthalmologists who listen to our podcast all the time. You know, when I did 500, 1,000 cataracts, boy, I thought I was so good.
Yeah.
And then you do 5,000 or 10,000, you think, gosh, I have so much to learn.
You do. And you know, I still find myself pushing myself. I still find myself challenged and
right.
having to pay attention to every single little detail.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching fellows has made me a better surgeon, much like being a cataract coach for you. Probably made you.
Sure.
That has really helped. pushing the boundaries and having to pay attention and critique them, which has made me better. But you are absolutely right. You definitely do not stop getting better. And you start to make better decisions, not just in the eye, but in clinic too. Like, I'm saying no to patients. I remember a point in my career where I was younger, I wanted to do as many cataracts as I could, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I'm asking patients, like, how are you seeing? And it doesn't really matter what I see outside. Like, how are you doing? How are you seeing? Right. Oh, I'm seeing pretty good. You have any trouble driving? No, I'm doing fine. How about
I'll see you in a year.
Yeah. I mean, what am I asking for trouble for?
Yes.
Yeah.
God, such an important thing, because at a younger age, you're just looking to do more cataracts. And yeah. I'm literally now finding myself saying to the patient, well, how are you seeing it? And I said, tell them, if you're seeing okay, if you're pretty happy with your vision, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
Totally. And patients, they really want you to tell them to do it. And you sometimes have to say, listen, this is not my decision. That's not how we do it anymore.
Right.
We do cataract surgery when you feel like your eyes are broken. They're not working well. You're having problems. You need to do something. Then we do it. If you're not having any problems, what are we taking an unnecessary risk for? As safe as it is, we still are taking small risks every time.
Right. So, that's what I also tell patients too. I only want to cook dinner for someone who's hungry. If you don't want the surgery, I don't want to do it.
No. And your technicians could throw you off. You come in the room, cataract console from a referring optometrist. You look at the eye. You look at the vision. You forget to ask them, how you do it?
Right, right.
Jump right in. Well, we could do this lens or that lens. No, you step back. Step one, do they even want to have surgery?
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're forced to be there. They think they should be there. They were told to go. Who knows? But yeah, it's amazing that the phases you go through in your career, and it goes by ridiculously fast, doesn't it?
I cannot believe that I'm halfway through my career. So someone pinch me. This cannot be halfway. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I know. Maybe more than halfway. Who knows? I mean, it's like, you know, we talk a lot about it. You just don't know what's coming, right? So you've got to enjoy what you have while you have it. Definitely health issues. You know, I'm big on heads up 3D surgery. I'm big on taking care of your body. I've had back surgery. I had a blown out disc.
Oh, wow.
It was so much from operating, but I think it was just abuse of my body over the years of skiing and water skiing and snowboarding and whatever. But it affects your ability to perform in the OR if you're in pain or you're not comfortable. So you got to take care of your body. You got to take, especially your neck and your back. It's huge.
Right. I mean, biggest thing for me, I see behind you the 45-pound plates. You got the whole gym set up here. I got a nice gym in my house, too. And you know what? Honestly, weightlifting at home, it's just, I have no pains, no back pains, no this. It's just something about that not only gets my stress out, but I just don't have any issues.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And with it, once I had my back surgery, I started working out with a trainer after about 6-8 months. Once it healed, I was kind of cleared. And since I've been working on core, unbelievable difference in my strength and my no chronic back pain, no achy back, stronger, huge importance. I wish I had started long ago.
Right, 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 right. No, that's an important thing. You also do know how to balance fun and work. And one of the things that's still on my to-do list right here, haven't accomplished it yet, is hang out with you, go out on a boat, let's go fishing a little bit, let's enjoy before the party's over.
Absolutely. I just got back from the Florida Keys lobstering. There's this mini season every year before they open the commercial season. Me and my family, we go down to the Keys and drive the boat down there, and we lobster for a couple of days and get all the fresh lobster. So I just got back from that.
You could feed me lobster every day for a year. I don't mind.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, that's fantastic. So tell me now, in your practice, what's new on the horizon? You always seem like you have a very cutting edge practice. I remember visiting you years ago. You were on the first practice to adopt everything. First practice that femtosecond laser, first practice to do like trials for the ultra new premium IOLs. You're always seeming like you're cutting edge. What's coming for us?
You know, it's weird. It's slowing down. There's a couple things that I think are on the horizon a little bit. I think that the mix space is going to continue to expand. There's a couple interesting companies, Violace, Elios, different technologies that cataract surgeons will be using, performing lasers, both in the clinic or maybe in the ASC, much like an SLT, but all more automated with femtosecond, that's Violace, or like a mixed procedure, but instead of putting in a device inside the eye, you'd be using like a probe with an excimer laser and treating the angle and putting perforations in it. So wow. Those, I think in the next year or two, we're going to have more MIGS opportunities that are a little bit more refined. I think MIGS is a little bit like, it's kind of like a shotgun approach now. Like we don't really have the technology to image the angle and say like, okay, well, this eye is better for hydrus based on its anatomy and the angle. And the outflow, and this one is better for, say, this one's better for an eye stent, or this one's better for a cannuloplasty. We're just like whatever your soup du jour is, you take, you know, they hand you an eye stent, cannuloplasty, all angles are the same. It's not true. If we were to able to like image the angle, like we could image other parts of the eye, that level of detail, you could see a little bit more about the anatomy in a 3D reconstruction. And you could probably tell which MIGS device has the best chance of success that's going to work in that patient's anatomy. I think that will evolve a lot, MIGS. I think it's good. For cataract refractive surgery, I know this sounds crazy, Uday, but we said this about femtosecond laser. There's a couple companies working on a robot to do cataract surgery.
Oh, I know.
I don't want to scare, and it's right out by you, too. And I don't want to scare all the young surgeons away from cataract surgery or refractive surgery, because you're still going to need one of the hardest parts about cataract refractive surgery. The surgery's hard. Yes, it does. But just as hard is making decisions for patients, when to do it, what lens to use, which eye to do first, what targeting to do. Robot can't do that. AI can't do that. Not as a human. Again, there's too many factors that go into that. And then somebody's going to have to control the robot. That might not be for 5 or 10 years, but that's coming for cataract surgery. And lens technology, you and I have seen this in our career. Lens technology is the one constant of change, right?
Yeah.
Just keeps changing. We just got the LAL, right, a few years ago. That was like groundbreaking. And look at it. It's exploding, okay? So we're going to see more. We're going to see more lenses, and we're going to see accommodating lenses come back in vogue. We're going to see dual optic lenses. We're going to see electronic lenses in our career. Maybe we will get our own eyes. Maybe our fellows or young colleagues will put them in your eye and my eye. But we're going to see electronic devices inside the eye that do more than just provide optics. They're going to be added functions and features, whether they lower the pressure or they dim or they have filters in them or they're controllable on your phone or who knows. But I mean, all the fields of medicine are going that way. So I think we're going to do the same thing.
Well, I think you're right. In terms of robotic stuff, and I do work with a company in the robotic space, but I'll just tell you, the robot's going to have a much easier time with a routine case, and it may want to save all the really tough cases for the humans.
Yeah, well, that's probably the way it's going to start. And it's probably going to just be like Charlie Kelman did. He's going to, the first surgeries are going to look a lot more rough than a cap did. Like, I'm sure the first phacos looked a lot more rough than an extra cap.
Right.
You know, eventually it took over and it matured. That's always part of the game, is the maturing of the technology.
No, for sure. These things always just get better and better. The other thing you also alluded to is judgment. Surgical decision trees are easy to teach, but surgical judgment is hard to teach. That's hard to learn even.
Yeah, well, it's from experience, right? And sometimes you'll learn by making mistakes, you know, and you learn from those mistakes. I had a patient who did monovision and contacts, and she had gone to see a young, nice, good surgeon in our community. And he loves putting in multifocals because it's a great technology. And he talked her out of monovision and said, well, this is better. This is both eyes get to be distance, middle, and near. She was miserable. She was unhappy. She had done monovision. Her brain was used to monovision. She came
right.
So it's like, and I've made that same mistake. You know, you gotta you just learn through these mistakes of what to do and what not to do sometimes. That's where the judgment comes from.
Right. No, very, very true. Very true. I mean, we've had the same issue. So, I learned now that patients are used to what they're used to. If they're coming to you with last 40 years of contact lens monovision, by golly, don't change that. That's what they like. Yeah. If they're coming to you and they've been a lifelong hyperope, if they end up, let's say they've been plus three their whole lives, if they end up plus a half, they'll love you. If they're minus a half, they will not.
Yeah.
And the opposite for the myopes, who will be happy at minus a half because they were minus six before, but when they're plus a half, they'll hate you.
Absolutely. You have to know where they're starting from and what they're used to.
Right, what the brain wants.
Yeah, and it's okay to change them, but you got to set their expectations and let them know what they're up for and what they're giving up to gain, you know? Right. I talk about sometimes with these different technologies that there's nothing perfect, and every one of these surgical plans or lenses that we use, they all have their Achilles heel. You got to pick your poison, okay?
Yeah.
With a multifocal, do you, for example, want to be able to be pretty free of glasses all the time, but have some glare halos at night and maybe not have the most sharpest vision in the distance as your friends do, who have all distance vision? Or would you rather have eagle eye distance vision and wear readers? Pick your poison.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess the important point is explain that it's all a compromise.
Right. Right. Which lets us know that there's room for improvement in new technology and lets our partners in industry know that we love what we have, but we want more for our patients.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Bring it on. Give us more technology, better lenses. Keep innovating. That's so critical.
If you're an ophthalmologist at the beginning of your career, just wait till mid-career. I look back at our careers where what was happening around the year 2000 compared to what is now. Oh my God, it's entirely different. Things didn't even exist then. Femtosecond lasers, liminal keratoplasty, anti-VEGF didn't exist. No OCT machines. None of this existed back then.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. None of that was around. And none of the refractive lenses were around. And we were just trying to, you know, do routine cataract surgery and not get an infection or tear a bag. Burn the cornea. There was a whole different set of things that we were worried about. Now we're worried about missing a target or choosing the right lens for the patient.
you're so right. It's a just different world.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of surgeons out there that this whole refractive arena is a little overwhelming, which I get, you know, like.
It can be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of stuff to digest, and I can see why a lot of people don't want to dabble in premium lenses or mess around with toric lenses or do monovision or do femtosecond lasers. It's expensive. It's more things to learn. The patient's expectations are high. You have to figure out how you're going to ask the patients for money in a medical specialty, which is kind of foreign to many people. So it's a different... It's a different animal altogether, and there's a lot of pieces to it. And if you're off target, you have to be able to fix it. You got to have an X-ray or laser.
Right.
A tune-up. You got to know how to do PRK or LASIK or SMILE or do an IOL exchange. Do you remember when you and I started operating or in residency first years of practice, the concept of going back in the eye to take out a lens was like an absolute failure. Like, this is the worst that could possibly happen to you. You would lose sleep for days about the concept, debating whether you needed to go back. You'd have to go back in the eye to do an IOL exchange. What's that? Right. Routine?
Yeah. It's just, you're right. Absolutely.
Amazing how things change.
No, it's a different world. Like for us, let's say in the year 2000-ish, the big conference, like you would go back in the eye. So what? They're plus two. Just give them some glasses.
Right. The risk of going back in the eye was so high, and it was considered almost malpractice. If somebody wound up with plus two, you'd have a group of your peers up there saying, the patient's correctable at 20/20. How could you ever go back in the eye? It's a 20/20 eye.
Well, or even look 20 years before us, 1980-ish, where all the academic people were saying, You can never put an IOL in the eye. That's a ticking time bomb in the eye. Don't put that plastic thing in the eyeball. Leave them AFib and give them the Coke bottle glasses. Remember that?
Yeah, I don't remember that.
I don't either, but I've heard the stories.
When I first came out of training and I came down to Florida, my dad taught me some of that stuff. And he taught me how Florida and California were very progressive in those times in doing things early. First places to do phaco, besides in New York with Charlie. First places to use implants, Jim Gills. And my dad followed suit with him and watched what he did and learned from him. So, like, you had places like, you know, Wills and Harvard, Mass Eye and Ear, all the institutions. Down here in Florida, these cowboys are doing stuff way ahead of them, which turned out to be the future. Right. Yeah, it's interesting.
And ophthalmology, it's one of the specialties where a lot of innovation actually comes from the private set world, private practice world, not necessarily from academia. It comes from both, but there are a lot of medical subspecialties where it's like almost all from academia. Ophthalmology is not that case.
No, you're absolutely right. First of all, most of the really experienced surgeons and high volume surgeons have done a lot of things are in the private sector. Second, industry has a much easier time getting your foot in the door, or you have business, a business-minded person who can make an executive decision and not have to go through a tree of meetings and executive committees and IRB reviews and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, it's a lot easier for probably for industry to get things jump-started and move quickly in the private world than ophthalmology.
No, for sure. With that said, I think your clinic does quite a number of clinical trials too.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the fun. You know, you have to pick and choose wisely. It's hard. Let me tell you though, like anybody who's thinking about doing clinical trials, it ain't doing it for the money. That's not the reason to
do it. Tell me, what are the challenges?
Recruiting patients.
Yeah.
Recruiting patients in today's world is extremely challenging unless it's something that's so germane to what you're doing every day. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say that you were doing a next generation multifocal lens came out. Okay. You're seeing patients every day that are multifocal candidates. Okay. Well, it would be pretty easy for you to sign up a patient with the next generation multifocal IOL, especially if they get it for free.
Right.
That's easy. But if you're looking to do, say, a MIGS device, or some other device like an implantable time release medication, that requires like a washout period for the patient and then an IOP check and then pressure checks that they have to come in every 6 hours. And then you have to have a staff member come in after hours to do that. And then people travel a lot, like in today's world, especially in Florida, Midwest, you've got snowbirds that spend the winter up in New York or, you know, the Northeast or in the Midwest, and they vacation down on the East or West Coast of Florida. Well, they're not going to make their follow-up appointments. That's hard too. So, you have to think of. So a shorter study is better. So I like IOL studies. I like viscoelastic studies. I like studies for new software, say for a femtosecond laser, things like that, that I know I can execute on.
Right. Because for the doctors who don't know, when you do a clinical trial, they are meticulous about the data. So you can't enroll 100 patients and then have follow-up for only like 40 or 50 or 60 of them. You want to enroll 100 patients, you need to have every post-op visit for all 100 patients.
Yes, and you need a technician that has been trained and assigned to how to work up and do that. You have to submit so many forms. You need a research coordinator. There's a lot to it. It's worth it, but you just want to dabble and slowly into it if you want to get into that and just start with something that's relatively easy to do and you feel like you have the right patient population and demographics to succeed with that.
Well, that's a key point too. In my clinic, I stopped years ago doing any clinical trials. The reason is I had such a hard time with recruitment.
Yeah.
Meaning I got a patient whose handbag costs more than my car. And I'm trying to tell the patient, sign up for this experimental this, and the company will pay you this small stipend. And they're just like, no, thank you. I'm good.
Right. They don't want to do anything that's going to require any extra work or time on their part.
Right.
And the ones that want to do it for the money are oftentimes not the right candidates for other reasons. They've got they're not meeting the inclusion criteria, right?
Right.
Other issues socially or personally that are going to prevent them from making their follow-ups, which you have to get done properly. That's it.
It's a whole big involvement, for sure.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
But one more thing that's very interesting is that a lot of young ophthalmologists may not realize that maybe about 15-ish years ago, the hottest thing was bimanual phaco.
Yes.
So you know what a bimanual IA probe is? You have to separate the infusion from the irrigation. Well, bimanual phaco is the same thing. You have an irrigating chopper, let's say, in your non-dominant hand, and then you have a phaco probe in the dominant hand, which does not have a sleeve on it and does not have irrigation. So you separated the irrigation from the aspiration on the phaco part of the procedure. And I tried it too. It was actually it started to gain in popularity and then started to wane a little bit. But you're to this day still doing it. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it all dates back to when I was invited by Howard Fine up to visit him and watch him do the first cases and do a mini fellowship in bimanual phaco. And for those people that may or may not know this, the whole reason that he started doing that is philosophically, it made sense logically to separate irrigation from aspiration so the two forces were not competing with each other, be able to use smaller wounds on the eye,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you don't need this big bulky sleeve around it. And what really allowed us to do this was the invention of the White Star software, which was
power modulations. Yeah.
Yes, and that was done by at the time was AMO, Advanced Medical Optics, which is now Johnson & Johnson. And they invented the first modulation software where the phaco needle did get hot. So when you step on the pedal, it sounds like the phaco's on, but it's really turning on and off like thousands of times per second. So you have a duty cycle, you have pulses per second,
mm-hmm.
have a larger pulse cycle. So you have three different modulations. At the end of the day, the bottom line is you can go pedal to the metal with the phaco and it doesn't get hot. The only time it would get hot is if you clog the tip with viscoelastic or nuclear material, you are at a very high power setting, and yes, the tip could get a little hot. But basically, it eliminated heat from the phaco needle, and all of a sudden, machines have that now. So when that happened, a group of surgeons got together and said, let's try to work on this. So I learned from Howard Fine, and I got my instruments from Larry Lacks of MST.
Mm-hmm.
These beautiful instruments at the time, very refined, gorgeous instrumentation. And we figured out that, like, we tried all different types of irrigators. First, there was like a closed irrigator with two ports on either side or three ports. And then we had like a curved irrigator. And then we came up with a different irrigating chopper design. So you had a long chopper, a short chopper, a sharp one. And then basically, I did, you know, then we had 19 gauge and 20 gauge. So if you went with, say, 19 gauge instrumentation, you have a larger bore, which means that you need less phaco power because you got a larger lumen to suck the pieces of nucleus.
Right.
If you go with a 20 gauge phaco needle, it's a smaller bore. You got to break the particles up with more phaco. So there's all these little nuances of fluid dynamics and balances. And the diamond blade has to match exactly the size because you don't have this big sleeve that acts as like kind of like a buffer that can either widen. Mm-hmm. So you have that, you have the risk of wound leak and chamber collapse if your wound does not meet the size of the instruments. So it takes a little bit of planning to have the right matching set of instruments to get it to work. But if you do all that, the control inside the eye is magical.
Mm.
And it allows you to operate at extremely high vacuum levels and very efficiently by keeping the irrigation in a controlled vortex pattern in the AC, pushing the iris down and back while you work deep inside the eye, sculpting, dismantling the nucleus, and evacuating it. You don't have any chaotic fluid movement inside the eye. It's much more predictable. The way I like to say it is when you have a coaxial unit, you've got fluid entering the eye out through the tip, around the sleeve and the needle.
All right.
Out of fluid going through those two holes in the sleeve on the side. Well, every time you twist or move your hand left or right, up or down, or twist it to get nucleus or move the bevel to orient it against the piece of nucleus, it's moving those two little holes in different directions. which is spreading fluid either this way, or this way, which can cause surprise attack. Because if the fluid's going like this, if your bevel's to the side and the fluid's going up and down and pushing the capsule down, and all of a sudden you turn your phaco needle a little bit like this,
capsule comes up.
Capsule will come right up.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of subtle, which causes us to do things like operate with a chopper below our phaco needle.
Yes, do that all the time.
Yeah. The only reason they teach you to put a chopper below that is because coaxial is dangerous, and that with the fluid dynamics, you can have this surge and this capsule pop up because of the fluid dynamics being so abruptly changed as you move your hand in the eye. But if you think about the bimanual technique, it's like having an AC maintainer in the eye as you operate. Right? As long as you're holding still. Now, you're not always holding it still. Sometimes you're chopping and you're doing things with it. But a lot of times you're just holding it in one place, shooting fluid across the angle, having it swirl around to form the stable pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And I just fell in love with it. And I just kept refining it. And then I think the true testament is that my fellows, I train them, they come, and it's interesting. Like, they go look at fellowships all over. They see what I'm doing. They're like, it resonates with them. Like, I'd like to learn that. They do it. Then they go out and practice and do it, you know, and they get the instruments, no big deal, and they stay with it. But I think, you know, it's any technique, like, you know, obviously coaxial is like, yeah, there might be like a handful of surgeons with two-way manual. So obviously coaxial is great. But I just think that, you know, there's a little bit level of control of fluid dynamics and things that you can do faster with bimanual that you can't really do with coaxial. And besides that, when you're talking about having a larger wound, you don't get iris prolapse. You don't get a lot of the floppy iris and iris prolapse we see with the Flomax cases is because you're putting your phaco needle down below the iris as you're sculpting, and fluid is now pushing the iris up, and it's making a trampoline up and down and down, which stimulates receptors and causes it to constrict. Bimanual is a lot different. You just put that irrigating chopper in the AC, and it just pushes that iris down flat against the anterior capsule, and you don't have all this movement and trampolining effect that causes the receptors to get fired and the shrinkage of the pupil. Plus, you've got a 1.5 millimeter wound, so even if you do have issues, it's just too small a wound and too tight a squeeze for the iris to get out. So it does help a lot in challenging cases. The same way bimanual INA helps, it's logical. If bimanual INA is better than coaxial INA, which a lot of surgeons agree there's more control that way,
sure,
doesn't it make logical sense that bimanual phaco would be better than coaxial phaco?
No, I totally get it. I get it absolutely.
So, you know, but it's a commitment. It's a commitment, Uday. It's different. And there's a learning curve. Just like anything else, you got to be willing to go through it.
I'm going to have to ask you for two videos now, the double torque IO on the bag video, and then just a routine cataract case of the bimanual. I don't know if we've ever even featured one cataract, maybe once, way, way long ago.
Let's do it. It's time to reboot it.
Yeah. So what pearls would you give to a young surgeon who says, you know what, I want to give this a try? Now, my pearl is you better go to Cataract Coach and look at our curriculum series. There's a whole section on phaco fundamentals. You need to understand phaco power modulations. What is duty cycle? The ramp up, what is burst, what is pulse, all these things you have to understand. And don't just ask, well, what do the other surgeons use? Set it yourself. But besides that, okay, they learn the phaco power modulations, they know how to set up settings that's not going to cause a corneal wound burn. Now what?
Okay, watch the videos, go look, read some books. There's books on mix that Amar Agarwal published. I wrote several chapters in them. Lots of our colleagues that we know in them early did. Lots of pearls, not just about it. Just about phaco in general, understanding fluid dynamics, phaco modulation power, learning how the eye behaves. Read the books, watch the videos, and then you contact MST. You get the right instrumentation. You get the right phaco needle. You talk to your phaco rep. You have them find out who they know that does bimanual settings, and you start with their settings. Or call me, or call Audrey Kelly Rostov, or call Dan Welch in Florida. Call one of my former fellows. Get some resources from another surgeon that's using the same machine as you. Get the right blade, the right irrigating chopper, the right phaco needle. This is not a flared phaco needle tip. This is a straight needle. because if you use a flare, you got to have a wider wound to get the flare in, and then it shrinks down, right? And then it leaks. So you use a more old school straight phaco needle. So it's a tight seal. So you've got to have the right equipment. And then she's, you know, it's amazing today. We're working, it's not happening fast, but we're working on it on a project now where we're going to be able to, let's say you were operating and you were operating off a 3D screen. Okay. You could look through the scope, but you had a 3D screen in your OR, like an Ingenuity or Zeiss, or, you know, whatever the Artivo or whatever you want to have 3D. You can let these things communicate. So if you have an interesting case, I can be in my OR. You can text me, say, Rob, you know, go to input 3 on your monitor, which is your OR. Yeah. And now I can see what you're doing with my 3D glasses or vice versa. And we can talk and help each other.
Yeah, that's why. I'm
far away from that. That, I think, is going to be really beneficial. But until then, you know, you've got to just do your homework and do a lot of reading and video watching and make sure you have the right information to get it done properly. Industry helps, MST instrumentation, the phaco company with the right settings, other surgeons who have done it that can give you some pearls and make sure you're all dialed in.
Absolutely. And then also, of course, as you said, watch videos. I mean, the beauty of videos now, and I think the godfather of videos is Bob Osher. When we were residents, we'd always watch his VHS tapes.
Yes.
Now you can say, okay, I've got a tough case coming up, or I want to learn bimanual phaco. You go to YouTube and you can watch dozens, if not hundreds of videos and study it ahead of time to go to the OR so much more prepared.
And watch your own videos that you do where you pick apart what you could have done better.
That is key. Watching game day footage. Every great athlete and surgeon has game day footage to learn from. No question.
Yeah, you have to. You have to really critique yourself. And the good surgeons are the ones that enjoy doing that. If you don't enjoy doing that, you're probably not going to be a great surgeon. You've got to get ridiculously passionate about your technique, whatever, and your outcomes and your efficiency. No wasted moves inside the eye. Maximum efficiency.
Right.
Minimum phaco power. Minimum fluid use and utilization. You've got to get into it and go take a deep dive on it if you really want to get great at it.
No, that's such great advice. I think, you know, the lucky thing is the next generation of ophthalmologists are really passionate. They learn so much. They're smarter than us. I'll be straight.
Oh, for sure.
They're learning what we learned, plus all the new stuff in the same amount of time. And then they shorten their learning curve by learning from the mistakes of others, which is something that was tough 20 years ago without YouTube, right?
Yes.
So the new generation is amazing. I have no doubt when it's time for my phaco, someone's going to do a beautiful job, but I do want a video.
Absolutely. And these young surgeons, I want them to take the baton that we're talking about right now, and I want them to validate and implement this concept of doing a fellowship after residency. I don't care what it's in. Glaucoma, peds, retina, plastics, cataract.
Do something.
Do something. It's just 3 years of ophthalmology is just barely enough to just get by. You're dangerous at that point. And this concept of just that they teach that you're just okay to go out and start practicing and doing cataract surgery on real people in your community after 3 years of training is crazy. You don't have to do a formal fellowship. You could find a mentor.
Right.
You could go join Uday in his practice, be a junior partner, and let him be with him for 20 years, and you get a 20-year fellowship with him. It doesn't have to be that complicated through the San Francisco Mass. You can do it that way. But
right. Absolutely. Find
someone who is going to take you under their wing, do an apprenticeship with them, have them as a resource for you when you get into trouble, when you have a patient you don't know what to do with, either emotionally or what to say to them. I mean, how many mistakes did we make in the exam room over the past 20 years of saying the wrong thing coming out of our mouth that just backfired on us?
Countless.
What a hard thing to learn. You learn listening to masters talk to their patients and the words they choose and how they communicate and their body language. It's as hard as surgery.
Yeah. Those subtleties. That's the stuff they don't teach you in med school or residency.
No. And then the business aspect, you know, you want to have a business, you want to be in private practice, you got to have a bridge. And I think that's the other thing that's kind of unique about the private practice fellowship opportunities, not just in cataract, but it's going to happen in retina and glaucoma. Is, you know, that's a bridge year between being in academics and being in the real world. Why do you just want to jump right into private practice? Why not have a little bridge to gap you into that and give you some of the skills and knowledge? Because it's a whole different world, right? If you're going into academics, it's a different story. But if you're going into private practice, that's a huge shift. You've been in school for college, med school, residency, all in this university-protected environment. All of a sudden now, you know, you've got to run a business or be part of. It's a different story.
Maybe I should apply for your fellowship. I'll be a killer fellow, buddy. I'll be an amazing fellow for you.
Sure you would. You'd make a better fellowship director and share your knowledge. But you've done so much today for... I remember when you started Cataract Coach, and I was like, what? So brilliant. I mean, you've always been a brilliant educator.
Oh, you're too sweet.
I had to do it. We used to have to do it by flying around the world. Uday flew around the world.
Yeah.
Doing his videos. Okay. Yeah. And then just so smart, you said, listen, I'm gonna do it from my house and get a much bigger audience. And then the brilliant thing that you do, Uday, is that you're not just showing your videos.
Everybody's
videos.
Yeah. So that's what I learned.
What about you? This is about showing all the different things that are going on out there. Like Bobby did, and Bobby really paved the way, but you've taken it to a whole new level. And think about how many patients you've helped, because you've helped surgeons, and then they help patients by learning from you. So
right. We all learn together. But you know what the funny part is? Now, yes, I do it from home or from my computer, but this year I will speak in 21 countries.
So you're back on the circuit, aren't you?
I'm just cranking. But you know, I'm loving it. It's like the good time. It's a good time in life. Kids are growing up out of the house, empty nester. It's a good time to travel. And I'm following my passions, what I'm doing.
That's all you can do. And it doesn't have to be stagnant. It can change. I've gone through phases too. My youngest is about to go to college, so I may have opportunities also to do more traveling and speaking. You just don't know where it's going to go. Or I might just do some more fishing today. I don't know.
You know what? Sign me up for the next fishing trip. That's been on my to-do list for a very long time. Rob, I want to thank you so much for this podcast. Always a pleasure to talk to you. I cherish our friendship that goes back two decades. And I hope that we can definitely do a fishing trip in the future.
Yes, we will do our next podcast from the boat.
Hey, I think that's a great idea. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, I've got a new podcast every single Sunday. You know where to find it. Anywhere you find podcasts, Apple's, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, wherever. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out. And we're going to have two Cataract Coach videos from Rob. Double torque eyewells in the bag for very high sill. And let's learn about bimanual phaco. Until next time, I'll catch you later.